Welcome to our main speaker for tonight, Richard from Long Beach.
Thanks, Willie. I'm Richard, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am delighted to be here, and happy New Year's Eve to everybody. You imagine a bunch of us, 100 of us sitting in this room tonight on New Year's Eve? Don't we have better things to do? God, could you imagine what it would have been like for some of us a few years back? Hey, yay, yay. Especially Crystal. I understand that girl drank some. Anyway, I was thinking I haven't been here for a long, long time. Last time I spoke here, I think Frank Honeycutt was still here, and Dave and Polly still lived here, and Alan was still here. And we go on, don't we? We either move on or go on, but a lot of us are still here. Larry's still here, and a bunch of the old-timers are still here, too, so I'm glad to be here. And I was thinking about New Year's Eve, and, you know, what did I do on New Year's Eve before? I got up in the morning, started to drank all morning long, got into the afternoon, kept drinking all afternoon long. Evening started, kept drinking on into the evening. Nighttime fell, and I drank all the way into the night, and eventually passed out at some point late at night. And that was every New Year's Eve. And for me, that was every other day of the year, too, because that's how I drank. I didn't drink any more or any less on New Year's Eve. And sometimes I wondered this day how we made it, at least how I made it anyway. And, you know, I didn't start off drinking that way. I started off drinking like a regular old kid. You know, I had guys in my neighborhood that were older than me, they were cooler than me, they were slicker than me, and I wanted to be like them. I wanted to be liked by them. I wanted to be one of them. And I watched them drink when they were, I don't know, 14 or 15 years old, and they seemed to enjoy it and have a good time. And I just thought, man, as soon as they will let me, I want to do that. I want to do what they do, because it looked like drinking was so much fun. And they did. Maybe when I was 13 or 14 years old, I got to start drinking with these guys. And immediately, the alcohol removed the fear that I felt. And I was a scared kid, you know. I was scared of parents and school teachers and police and girls and everybody. And when I drank the booze, all the fear left. And I started paying a price for it right away. When I was 16 years old, I was going out on my first official date. And I think it was official because it involved a girl and a car. And so I'm thinking, you know, I'm a little bit nervous about this, so I better get some booze to drink to, you know, get ready for the date. So I get some booze, and I'm getting ready to leave for the date, and I think, I don't know if this much booze is going to do the trick. I don't know if it's enough. And I had a pint of vodka or something. And I thought, well, I have these other things that help with respect to that. And the big book refers to them as high-powered sedatives. And the medical profession called them barbiturates. And we called them reds. So I thought, this will take the edge off. So I gobble some of those down, drink my booze on my way out to pick up the date. And I remember pulling up in front of where she lived, and it's the last thing I remember. And I don't know what happened at the alleged date. I don't know if it happened. I don't know anything about it. But all I know is that late that night, like 2 in the morning, I'm driving home from the supposed date, and I lived here in Long Beach, and I was driving up Studebaker in my mom's Plymouth station wagon, and on my way home to my parents' house, and I got, you know, right to this point where you have to dip inside of an island and keep going straight, so you have to do a little dip like that, and I over-dipped because I was wasted, and I smashed into a parked car, and I hit it so hard it went up on the lawn, that my car went up on the lawn with it, and here I am up on somebody's front lawn, and I just think to myself, oh, bummer, better get out of here. So I backed down off of the lawn, put it in D for dad away, and off I went. And I was really close to home. You know, I drove about a block down, 2 blocks over, half a block back, parked the car, went inside and went to sleep like nothing had happened. And, you know, the guy whose lawn the car landed on, well, it was his car, his lawn. He heard the commotion. He called the police. They followed my tire tracks down a block, over 2 blocks, half a block, into a driveway. There was a crash car, and they came up and arrested me for driving under the influence of alcohol and dangerous drugs and for hit and run. And I was 16 years old, and prior to that, I had never been in any serious trouble. You know, everything, I had skated by okay up to that point. And, you know, shortly after that, I was thrown in jail again. This time was for contempt of court. My friend went in to take care of a ticket. I went in to tell him something, and I was so loaded, they put me in jail and let him go. And, you know, a little while after that, I'm driving home. By the time I was 16, 17, 18 years old, I'd become a daily drinker, and I drank every single day and did a lot of those other things, you know. And I'm driving home one night when I was about 18, and I get almost home, and I got hungry, and I thought, man, I better eat something before I go to sleep. And then right then, this is when, you know, drive-through places were new, like McDonald's and Jack in the Box. These drive-throughs were new. And I knew how drunk I was, and I thought, you know, if I pull into that Jack in the Box, which was the plan, and then you got to make those sharp left turns, right? And a quick left, and another sharp left, and back then you used to order into Jack's head. There was this gigantic clown of Jack in the Box with a little speaker in it. So you order into the head, and then you pull forward, you get your food, and you drive off to go home. That's what you're supposed to do, but I knew I was so drunk, I probably couldn't pull it off. But I had to eat, so I thought, well, the responsible thing to do here so that I don't get arrested for Jack slaughter is pull up in front of Jack in the Box, walk up, get my food, get in my car, and drive home. That's the responsible thing to do. In my drunken condition, I knew that. So I parked the car right in front of Jack in the Box. I walk up to the window. There's two men in line in front of me at the window. The guy directly in front of me in line at the window turned around and arrested me. And he was a policeman. He was off duty. He didn't have a uniform on, but for some reason he had handcuffs with him. And to this day, I don't know if that's normal or if he was just a little bit kinky. I'm not sure. But he held me there, and then they took me off to jail again. So now I'm 18 years old. I've been in jail three times, all for alcohol and drugs. And all I learned during that time wasn't that I wanted to do any less of what I was doing, but what I learned during those experiences was how much I hated jail. I just hated jail. I mean, some people can do jail. I have friends that can do jail. I'm not one of them. They put me in jail. You better make sure I don't have a belt with me because I'm probably not going to last. And so anyway, I had to spend the rest of my life figuring out how I could continue to drink as much as I wanted and needed to drink without going to jail. And I was pretty successful at it for a long time. I spent about 10 years without going to jail. I went to school. I worked full-time. I drank full-time. I was able to drink where I worked. The boss drank just like I did, and he owned the company. And we drank at work. It's just how we started off in the afternoons, and as the years went by, we drank earlier and earlier. When we're drinking at lunch, then we're drinking all day. And then we're showing up for work at 8:30 in the morning and putting our hands out and seeing who's shaking the less, and that one would go to the store and get the booze and come back, and we would just sort of just maintenance drink all day long, you know. And then for me, that always led into just being horribly drunk by the end of the day. And that's how I could work there that long, because he drank like I did. And I got to the point, though, when I was about 20, well, actually, let me just tell you, when I was about 26 or 27 years old, if you would have said, Richard, how's your life? Like, how is it right now? I would have said, I don't think I can get any better than this. I got the greatest life, you know. I lived in Belmont Shore. I had this great job where I could drink at work. I made decent money. I drove a little black Porsche. I lived on St. Joseph. I had a little side business, this commodity business, you know. And I had customers all up and down 2nd Street, all the bars, so I knew every bartender and every waitress on 2nd Street. And I would have just said, I had all these friends. I had a lot of girlfriends. Life can't get much better than this. And I'm paying a big price for it because I'm sick every day. I wake up horribly sick because I drink so incredibly much. And I wake up just sick, and I'm throwing up all the time, and I'm shaking all the time, and I'm getting sicker and sicker from the inside out from this thing called alcoholism. But right then, I would have said, no, man, it's working. This is good. Now, I get to about 28 years old, and I can't make it to work anymore. I can't get to work to have that first drink with my boss. So I'm having to drink a half pint in the morning before I even leave the house. And then sometimes before I leave the house, I drink that half pint of vodka, and I think, that's not quite enough. That's not going to get me. It's a 3-mile drive, you know. That's not going to get me from here to there. So I drink a little more, and I'm telling you, as soon as I put a second half pint in me, I wasn't going anywhere. I was home for the day, you know. And I realized that, within the short amount of time of that going on, that I just wasn't going to be able to work anymore. Because I knew I couldn't not drink, because I had never been able to not drink since I was about 16 years old. Drank every day. So I thought, well, the job's got to go. So I was working late one night, and I was drunk as usual, and I left a letter of resignation and went home at some point, and they owed me some money, and I went home, and in my letter I said, I'll be by tomorrow to pick up the money you owe me, and I went home, passed out, and got up the next morning, remembered everything that had happened, and I went down there to the office, and they had the money ready for me. They had a check ready for me, and they were ready for me to be gone. So they gave me the check. It was $2,000. And I started thinking to myself, okay, this is good. I got $2,000, but I can't probably ever work again because I got to drink every morning when I wake up, and I have to drink all day once I start. And I don't know of any other job where they will allow that. So my trick is going to be, how do I stretch this $2,000 into the rest of my life? So it's going to take some, you know, creative and very, well, it's going to take something. So anyway, what I used to do for my part-time work, I decided to make that my new full-time job. And, you know, I was a guy that liked my product line way too much, and, you know, just do the math. It wasn't going to last long, right? And before long, I'm getting something from you to sell to you to pay you, and I'm doing the shell game with a lot of dangerous people, and I'm going downhill real quickly, and before long, everything's gone, and I'm visited by the bad guys, and they got weapons, and they want me, and they want, you know, they have instructions, and they're not pleasant. The alternatives weren't pleasant. Anyway, I wound up giving them my car. And they left, and now everything was gone. I'm about 28 or 29 years old, and everything's gone. And about 2 weeks after that, there's a knock on the door. I answer the door, and there's two deputies standing there. And they said, Richard Wade, what am I going to say? And, yeah. They said, step outside. And you know, when I first saw them, I thought they were going to come in and arrest me for what I'd been doing around there. But when they said, step outside, I immediately thought, no, wait a minute, this is actually going pretty good. Because if they're going to arrest me for what's been going on around there, they're going to come inside with a search warrant. They're not going to be all polite and say, please step outside. So as I'm stepping outside, I'm thinking, maybe they just want me to help them solve a caper or something, you know? Maybe they want my assistance, and they didn't. As soon as I stepped outside, one of them pulled the door closed behind me, and they put a padlock on the door. They said, you've now been officially evicted. You can never go back in that apartment again. I said, what about my stuff? And they said, it's not your stuff anymore. It now belongs to your landlord. This is cruel, the things they do to you, you know? And I had on a pair of Levi's and a pair of tennis shoes. I had my wallet in my pocket, and I had a T-shirt on. And they said, so you can't go in there anymore, and so you need to start walking. We know what you've been doing around here. We know you don't have your car anymore, so we want you to start walking, and we're going to make sure that you walk until you leave the city of Long Beach and the county of Los Angeles. And if we see you in this county or the city again, you'll be arrested. And I said, for what? What are you going to arrest me for? And they said, you don't need to worry about that. We'll fill in the blanks. So I start walking, they're on me, and I'm walking down St. Joseph, I get to 2nd Street, I walk into, you know, Seal Beach is a different city and a different county, it's my closest out, and they followed me until I walked over the little bridge into Seal Beach. And then when I went over the bridge, they made a U-turn and went back like they had just run Al Capone out of town. And I swear one of them looked like Barney Fife, I'm telling you. And I started walking across that bridge into this town, and I had nowhere to go. I didn't have any other plans. I didn't have any other alternatives. My dad had just watched my mom die from alcoholism. He couldn't stand to look at me. My brother and sister had given up on me. My old friends are long gone out of sight. And my other business associates, I'm not on great terms with a lot of them. And I started walking into Seal Beach thinking, I have nowhere to go. And it's at that point, when I think back in my life, I think that's the point at which I wish I would have known about you. I wish I would have known about AA. I wish I would have known about detoxes or recovery programs or recovery houses. I didn't know you or any of that stuff existed. And I started walking that day, and I walked for the next 4.5 years. And for 4.5 years, I didn't have a place to live. I didn't have a home. I didn't have an address. I didn't have a car. I didn't have any income. I didn't have any money. I didn't have any insurance. All I had was a disease, alcoholism. And it just got worse and worse and worse. And I learned what I had to do to get booze into my system every day. And it didn't matter if it was illegal or immoral or unethical. Nothing mattered. But when I woke up in the morning, liquor had to go into my system to stop the shakes and to stop this head a little bit. And I did whatever you can imagine. Use your imagination. I probably did it, and I did whatever was necessary, and I just drank, and I just drank that. I lived that life. I remember once, like, running up to this gas station over on, there used to be a gas station on Main and PCH, and I was a block away from it. And when you're a drunk and you don't eat, sometimes you gotta go. And when you gotta go, there's no turning back. You got to go. And I saw somebody walking out of the bathroom in that gas station, and I remember like running up there best I could to get to that. And I reached the handle and it was locked, you know. So I ran into where the guy was working in there. I said, "Man, I gotta use your bathroom. Can I have the key, please?" And the guy says, "No, it's out of order." You know. And Multiply it times 100, you know, and that kind of, you know, when the big book talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, I just think about, if it were only that bad, I would have kept drinking. You know, it was so far beyond that, and this disease is so far beyond any descriptions I've ever seen. And I couldn't stop, and I didn't know there was a way to stop, and I didn't know any of us ever stopped at that point, you know. After about 2 years of that, I had snuck back into Long Beach by my own wit and guile, and I was drinking with the fellows down by the park. Well, there's this park down by the police station. Police station, courthouse, library, park. And why winos drink in parks next to police stations, I don't know, man. But there we were, me and the fellas, you know, drinking wine out there. And I'm just drunk as usual, just drunk, just always drunk. And I saw a girl park her car, and she was going to head toward the courthouse. And I recognized this girl, and I hadn't seen her in 10 years. I used to party with this girl. I lived with her for a while, and I knew that she drank just like me. I mean, she drank for drink with anybody I ever knew. And I saw her get out of her car, so, you know, I was going to go cut her off and maybe strike up a little conversation, maybe get $5. What the heck, you know, but at least say hi to her. And when I approached her, you know, she didn't recognize me at first. And I didn't look the same as I did 10 years before that. You know, I was 10 years older, 10 years drunker, you know, 10 years skinnier from not eating. You know, I had long, long matted hair and a long matted beard, and my blood vessels were all burst in my face, you know. And then she got a little closer look at me, and she figured out I was who I said I was, and we started to talk. And now her, on the other hand, she looked great. She looked clean and well-dressed and well-kempt and healthy, and she just looked better than I could ever remember her, you know. And we talked, and I said, well, so what's been going on with you? And she said that she had just got out of this thing, this program thing. And I didn't know what she was talking about, this program thing. And she was a flight attendant. She used to fly money for some bad guys, and she got caught. And she says part of her sentence was to go to a drug and alcohol treatment place. She said she went to a place called Long Beach General Hospital, and she was in there for 4 weeks, and she had now been out of there for 3 weeks. So she says, I haven't had anything to drink or use in 7 weeks. She was my Eskimo, you know. She was the one, she was the first person I ever knew in my life who I knew used to drink like me, who was standing there right in front of me telling me she hadn't had anything to drink for 7 weeks. That might as well have been 7 years or 70 years. To me, it was so incomprehensible. And we talked for a few minutes, and she told me about this place. She says, yeah, it's a great place. And then she told me a little bit about her case, and she was going into the courthouse to turn in some final paperwork. And then I could tell she had to go, so we started to say our goodbyes, and then she stopped me, and she says, you know, she looked me over in the condition I was in. Plus, I smelled really bad, you know, and she looked over this thing I had become, and she says, you know, Richard, if it ever gets really bad for you, she said this place I was in might take you, because they have a certain number of beds for what they call indigents, and she says, you might qualify. Like, oh, yeah, man, I've made it to the land of indigent, and so she tells me where the place is, and she goes to court, and I go back to drinking with the guys, but now my bubble was burst. Now I could no longer say that nobody like me ever stopped, because now I had met one person who had. She was the first person I'd ever met. The people that I ran around with never stopped and came back and reported how great sobriety is. I never heard those words from anybody. And they either kept doing what they were doing, or they went to jail, or they died, or they moved out of my line of vision, you know. But here she was telling me this. So I kept drinking after that. And at some point after that, I realized I couldn't go on anymore. I was dying from alcoholism. You know, I had all kinds of physical problems, aside from everything else that had been stripped from me. Now I'm getting really, really bad physical problems. And so I finally thought, if I don't stop this, I am going to die. And I went to that hospital. It was a county hospital, and they took me in as an indigent, and they gave me a bed, and I went to detox. And after whatever many days in detox, they let me stay for this program, which was about 30 days long. They kept me longer because they said, usually we have people here for 30 days. In your case, we're going to keep you here until we get you up to 140 pounds. And I'm 6'1", and I went in there thin. And they did. They just kept shoving peanut butter sandwiches in my face, you know, left and right. And finally, after maybe 35 days, you know, I just felt great. I had stopped throwing up. My head slowed down a little bit. The shake slowed down a little bit. Mostly, I was holding down food for the first time in years and years and years. And people from AA were coming in and talking to us on panels, telling us about this, you know, and they're having their usual rehab stuff in there, and I just thought, man, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard of in my life. Here I'm, you know, I'm drunk every day for however many, 16 years or something, and now I'm in here. I haven't had a drink for 3 or 4 weeks, and all I want to do when I get out here is come to you and do what you do and do what you've been telling us to do when you've come in and talked to us. And I was so looking forward to that, and my mind was made up that was my plan, you know. And I finally got released from there, and I started walking from, it was on Redondo and Willows, where that hospital was. And I started, when I got out of there, I started walking because I still didn't have a car, and I walked up to PCH, and I walked out of there, and all I wanted was you. And I got to Pacific Coast Highway, and all I wanted was a drink. And I don't know how to explain that except I'm an alcoholic. And I walked right into that liquor store, and I got some booze, and I got drunk the day I got out. And I'm going to shorten my story now, but that happened 15 more times where I couldn't go on the streets anymore, not one more day. So I'd find a place like that, always county detox. I'd find one more place to take me one more time, thinking if I can just get 3 or 4 days sober, I won't have to drink when I wake up in the morning. And I would go there, and that would happen, and I would get out, and I would get drunk the day I got out. Every time, you know. And I don't know how to explain it, but it's explained really well in here. As a matter of fact, the best description in here is I think, in the chapter to the wives, where it talks about husband number 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I was nobody's husband, but I was a number 4 description of an alcoholic who gets drunk on their way home from the place they went to get sober. And I don't know how else to describe it, except for that's just... But my life was, that's how my life was then. And then after all of those attempts and all of those years on the streets and all of that degradation and physical pain and emotional pain and spiritual pain, all of that, I finally got to the point where I couldn't try anymore. I just thought, I can't do this anymore. In between these facilities I kept going to, I was coming to AA, but I was always drunk. I would be drunk when I got here. And come drunk. I say, oh, I mean, I'm glad nobody ever threw me out for coming drunk. But the problem was I could never hear the message because I was too drunk to hear it, right? And so all these meetings I went to, all these facilities I went to, you know, 16 attempts, really attempts at getting sober, and I wasn't working. And I finally got up. You know, it's one morning, I'm drinking a fifth of vodka, and I get it just about done, and I realize I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. Look how many times I've tried. Look how many times I failed. By this time, I had cirrhosis of the liver. It's very painful, you know. My pancreas doesn't work anymore. Very painful stuff, you know. 4 months before this, I'd been given 6 months to live by a hospital in a different county hospital because my organs weren't working anymore. And I thought, man, I got 2 months to live, maybe. And I can't do the time. I just can't do it. It just hurts too much, you know. All of it hurts too much from the inside out. And so with a fifth of vodka in me this one morning, I just thought, I'm not going to do it. I'm not trying anymore. I'm not coming to you anymore. I'm not going to those places anymore. I'm not even drinking anymore. I'm done being on this planet. And my solution to the disease of alcoholism was to pump up this vein, which I happen to know how to do. And I put a Swiss Army knife blade down underneath the artery there, and I pulled forward, and I laid down to die. Because I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't do this anymore. I couldn't try anymore. I couldn't stand it anymore. I couldn't stand me anymore. And, you know, obviously somebody found me, and they carted me up and rushed me to a hospital, and they put 30 stitches in my arm, and they kicked me out. They said, we don't keep your kind in this hospital, because it wasn't a county hospital. It was a nice hospital. They threw me out. And that night I got drunker all over again. I got up in the morning, and I was furious that I'd been found. And I was furious that I was going to have to endure another day, let alone another few weeks or another few months. And I drank some vodka that morning. I got a fifth of vodka somehow, and I, you know, drank that up just in a state of just an unbelievable state of mind, where I was just furious that I was still on this planet. And as I was drinking all that, I had this thing we hear about sometimes in these rooms, and it's this thing called a moment of clarity. Now, my moment of clarity had a fifth of vodka whooshing around in it, so it may not be the clearest moment y'all ever heard of, but I realized I was, in fact, going to die real soon. I was going to die never having known whether or not there was any merit to live life sober, because I'd never done it. I hadn't lived life sober since I was 14 or 15 years old. And I thought, well, I could try this thing one more time. I could try this AA business one last time. And if it doesn't work, well, I'm going to die anyway pretty soon, so what the heck. And if it does work, maybe there's a chance. I don't know, but I'm going to try one last time. And I called AA that day, and they sent two men to where I was, and they called every detox around. None of them would take me. They say, we don't take him anymore. They finally found a place for me all the way up in El Stinking Money. And they hauled me out there and got me in there. And I don't know how to explain that day to you, because I was drunk, you know, but something was happening to me that day. And you know, Chuck C. used to always talk about the surrender. You got to surrender. And then Dr. Paul always talked about, well, there's this thing about acceptance, you know. Those were the key things that were happening to me that day. I didn't know it, and I don't know which came first, and quite frankly, I don't care. But that day, it was getting way down deep inside of me that to drink was to die, and maybe I didn't want to after all. And there was acceptance, and there was surrender. And it was so much so that by the time I got out to that detox, I knew I didn't need to be there. I knew I needed to finish the drunk off, but I didn't need to be in that detox. And somehow I got back down here, and I got some more booze, and I realized that I'm going to finish off this booze tonight, and I'm not going to do this again. And I don't know where that came from, except for something mystical was happening inside of here. And I went over to Carol Cry's, and some of you remember Carol Cry's. She used to live on Ocean, and she was an old friend of mine. We got drunk a lot together, and she was sober a couple of months, and I banged on her door hoping she would let me in, and I could finish off this booze I had and then start my sobriety on that couch of hers. And she did let me in, and she was furious when she saw that I had a quart of vodka and a 12-pack of beer, but what the heck, you know, you take the good with the bad, right? And I drank up all that booze on her couch that night, and I was thinking to myself as I was drinking it, because by that point, I hated alcohol. I hated everything about alcohol, especially what it had done to me in the last 3 or 4 years. But I was drinking that alcohol that night thinking, this is the last time I'm ever going to have to do this. And tomorrow I'm going to be sick, and it's the last time I'm going to have to be sick. And I don't know for sure where all that came from. But I drank up all that liquor, and late that night from her living room, I called a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was a man I had heard speak at a meeting. I was drunk. He was the speaker. I had identified with him. He had given me his phone number. I hadn't called him in my life. And that had been about a year and a half. I had that man's phone number in my pocket. That night I called him. And he knew who I was because he had seen me in these meetings drunk all the time. Oh, yeah, you're the guy that's always in the back throwing up. Yeah. Claim to fame, you know. And so anyway, that man talked to me that night. And, I'm at the end of my second drunk of the day. I'm one day away from 30 stitches in my arm. I'm a soon-to-be-dead alcoholic. And he took the time to talk to me that night. And he talked to me for quite a long time. And I don't remember a lot of what we talked about because I was so drunk. But I do remember by the time I hung up the phone, I had some hope. So now I've gone through this surrender and acceptance business, and I wind up with this man with some hope. And I pass out on Carol's couch, and he told me, stay there, and he says, when I get home from work tomorrow night, I'll take you to an AA meeting. So when I woke up the next morning, I was as sick as I had ever, ever been, which meant I had to drink when I'm that sick, and I didn't pick up a drink that morning because of what happened the day before and the hope this man had given me the night before. And I stayed on that couch all that day, and I threw up all day long. And I get as sick as I get when I don't drink, which is horribly sick, but I didn't pick up a drink because there was some hope in here. And finally, about 5:30, the phone rang over there, and it was him. And I thought he was going to say, Richard, I'll be over in a few minutes to take you to a meeting. And he didn't say that. He just talked to me. And he talked to me like one alcoholic supposed to talk to a new guy. And we talked for about an hour, and during that hour, he told me that it mattered to him whether or not I got sober. Like, it mattered to him. And he told me it mattered to him whether I lived or died. And he told me he loved me. And all he knew about me is I'm the drunk in the back of the room that can never get sober. An hour he talked to me and just kept reassuring me that I mattered and that maybe I could make this thing, you know. And after about an hour of it, I finally said, are we going to go to one of those meetings tonight or not? Because I was so sick, I didn't know if I could physically go. And he said, no, I can't take you to a meeting after all. And I asked him why not, and he told me that his father had died that day. And he had to fly back that night to Fort Wayne, Indiana, to help his mother make his father's funeral arrangements. And I thought to myself, Jesus, this guy's dad just died, and when he should be making his flight arrangements and driving to the airport and getting on an airplane and flying to Indiana, instead of doing all that, he spent an hour with me on the phone to tell me I mattered. I've never forgotten that, and I will never forget that, you know. And that's the last day, and that's the day I celebrate my birthday on. And a few months ago, I celebrated 29 years without having to have a drink, and it started the day that that man gave me that hope and let me know that I mattered as a human being. And so I've had this crazy life, you know, ever since, and I had a pretty incredible life. And, you know, I know at least half the people sitting in this room, and I've known many of you for a very, very long time, and I'm so happy about that. But, and so a lot of you know my story, and a lot of you have heard me tell my stories over and over again over the years. But But I'm going to just tell you maybe two stories. Maybe, well, whatever. We'll see. So I stay sober after that, and I get a job, and I come to AA, and I come every single day, and that guy remains my sponsor, and I study the big book, and I work the steps, and I try to be of service. I just do all the stuff, just the stuff that everybody in this room that's been sober longer than a week knows that they ought to do. So I just did the stuff, and I got to stay sober, and I got to, my life began to improve right away, and then it got better and better and better over the years. And when I was about 10 years sober, by that time I was working for this consulting company, and I was helping to run the company, and I had clients around Southern California and a few in some other states, and one of my local clients said, "Can you go help our corporate people in Chicago with some stuff?" And I said, "Sure." So I was going to fly to Chicago and meet with this company for maybe 2 hours, fly back the same day, and, you know, just sort of do a scoping meeting to set up the work. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, I'm going to Chicago for the first time, and I'm a baseball fan, so I better stay for the weekend and take in a game at Wrigley Field, or they could take away my baseball cards or something. So anyway, I plan, okay, I'll stay the weekend. And then I'm looking at the calendar, and I thought, well, I'm going to go here around the first week in June, and by the time I was 10 years sober, I'd become a real AA history nut. Like, it became a passion of mine. I just love learning about AA history. And in the second week of June every year, they have this thing called the Founders Day Celebration. Tony's probably even talked there, you know. I mean, it's a big convention, and it's to celebrate the beginnings of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's always around June 10th every year. And I'm looking on my calendar. I'm going Chicago, June 3rd, Akron, Ohio, June 10th. And I look at this map of the country. Chicago to Akron's only about that far. I'm going, man. So I tell the boss I'm taking a week off, and I'm going to just take some time off. And, you know, he was fine with it. He didn't know why. He didn't need to know why. So that was my game plan, was to go to Chicago, do some work, then take a couple of days and drive over to Chicago and go to the Founders Day Convention. I run this by my sponsor, and he said, well, during that week when you're driving from Chicago to Akron, he said he was going to be flying into Fort Wayne, Indiana to see his mother. He hadn't seen his mother in 10 years. He hadn't seen his mother since he went back there to bury his father, right? And he said, so when you leave Chicago, why don't you drive down to Fort Wayne, hook up with me one night, we'll go to an AA meeting together, because I love going to meetings when I travel. And then the next day you can drive on up to Akron. So I thought, what a great idea. That's what I'm going to do. So that was a game plan. The day before I was going to leave, he called me. He said, you know, forget about the trip down to Fort Wayne. He says, he couldn't leave. He had to stay here. He had some business stuff to do. And he said, so forget about going to Fort Wayne. And I said, I don't think so. I said, I think I'm going to go say hi to your mom. And she was really sick, and she's in a hospital. That's why he wanted to go see her, and she's really old. And he couldn't figure out why, and I couldn't figure out why, and he thought it was weird, and I thought it was kind of weird too. But anyway, he says, well, anyway, here's her full name and the hospital she's in and her room number. If you want to go see her, go see her. So anyway, I went to Chicago, did my stuff. Then I rented a car and I drove to Fort Wayne, Indiana. I found her hospital. I found her room, and I walk in her room. She has a little room all by herself. She's an old, frail woman and a lot of equipment hooked up to her. And I went up alongside of her bed and I said, hi, my name's Richard, and I'm a friend of your son Ted's from Southern California. I said, do you mind if I sit down and talk to you for a few minutes? And she was happy to have a visitor. You know, she said, I'll pull up a chair. So I pulled up a chair alongside of her bed, and I spent the next 4 hours telling her about her son and about the kind of man he had become and about the fact that the day her husband had died, her son had given me my life, and 10 years had gone by since then. And we had this wonderful, wonderful talk. It was so wonderful that about 11 o'clock at night, under threat of arrest, they pulled us apart. Because they come in to tell me, visiting hours are over, they're over, they're over. And we didn't want to part company. She was so excited to hear these things about her son. They didn't talk. They never talked. They were this Italian family. They just never talked. And he had been run out of that city when he was 16 years old. He only talked to his mom a few times, once when he went to bury his dad. And so we had this great, great, great long talk. And at some point she got on the phone. She made me talk to her sister, who was even older. Because she wanted her sister to hear that her son had turned out okay from somebody else, you know. And so anyway, we had this great, long, long conversation. I finally leave, and I go up to Akron the next day and went to the convention, which was just great, and the whole Akron history thing was so great to be there. And then I flew home after that, and about 3 weeks after I got home, I got a call from my sponsor, and he says, I just wanted to let you know that my mom just passed away. And I said, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. And she was sure a nice lady. He said, I said, did you get back to see her before she died? And he says, no, I wasn't able to go. I didn't know she would die that soon, and I wasn't able to get there. I said, that's too bad. And he says, yeah, it is too bad. And he says, but, you know, something happened. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, you know, my mom and I only talked once or twice in the last 10 years until you two had your little visit. And then he said, we talked every day after that until the day she died, and everything seemed to be okay with us. You know, the nature of our relationship seemed to have changed, and I thought, isn't that great, you know? And, you know, people that hear me around here, I always talk about those full circles. You know, the day his dad died, Ted gave me my life, and 10 years later, just before his mom died, I kind of got to pinch hit for him, and we completed a full circle, and that kind of thing has happened in my life over and over again, and in your lives, because I hear your stories all the time too. And sometimes these circles are happening to us, and sometimes we're a part of somebody else's circles, right? I mean, if you sponsor people, you know what I'm talking about. And I remember this one time when I was, maybe I was about 5 years sober, and I've always been kind of a service nut in AA, like an old H&I junkie, you know. I finally gave up my last panel, but I only kept it for 25 years because I believe in rotation of service. But anyway, I always like to experiment around, like, you know, be a GSR for a couple of years, be a this, be a that, whatever, just do it. You know, we need people to, like, help out. So I was about 5 years sober, and I'd taken on this thing about answering the phones for Long Beach Central Office at nighttime. When the office closes, they patch the calls through to your house. So you answer the phone in your house, AA, like you're the real thing, and you're really a guy in his PJs. But people on the other phone, on the other end of the phone, they don't know that. So anyway, I used to take those calls once a month. Great commitment. You don't even have to leave your house. It's this great commitment to do. You're really being of service, and it's fun. And the later the night gets, the more amusing the calls get. It's freaking hilarious. So anyway, this one night I'm taking those calls, and I get a call from a guy around 7:30 at night, and he is so drunk that I can hardly understand him, you know. But he also sounds kind of desperate, you know. And so I talked to him for a few minutes, and then and I finally said to him, you know, I think I know right where you are, you know. And I think you're going to have to stop drinking, or you ain't going to make it. And probably the only thing that's going to help you to stop drinking is Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's what saved me. You know, that's what saved my life. And I said, I can send somebody over there right now and pick you up and take you to a meeting. He goes, but I'm so drunk. I said, I don't care. I went to meetings drunk a long time. I can get you a ride there right now. And he, you know, he kept backing off and, you know, changing his mind like they're so often do, you know. And then finally he just says, I'm not going to go tonight. If I'm going to go to one of those meetings, I'll wait till tomorrow. And I said, well, okay, but if you do decide to go tonight, and if you can get a ride from somebody, I told him where a meeting was close to where he said he was, you know, and I gave him the address of it, and we finally said our goodbyes. And then, so the night goes on, yada, 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 and then I get another phone call about 10 o'clock, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the same guy. He called back, you know. He says, well, this is... I'll call him Drew, because that's his name. He says, I went to that meeting after all. Like he said, my neighbor took me. I went there, and he says, you know, maybe there's some hope. I said, yeah, you know, and now he's a little more lucid. He hasn't had anything to drink in 3 hours. So we talked for about an hour that night, you know, and I told him part of my story, and I listened to his story, and I told him why I thought this program could work for him. And before we hung up the phone, I told him that it mattered to me whether or not he got sober, and I told him it mattered to me whether he lived or died, and I told him I loved him, and I told him about some other meetings to go to, and then we finally said our goodbyes, and that was it, right? No. About 3 weeks later, I show up at my little home group. At the time, it was this little group over here on 8th and Central here in Seal Beach, and a little discussion group. And I showed up there really late. There's only 5 minutes left in the meeting when I got there, because I was coming from a panel at Wayne Fanning Industrial Strength Detox and El Stinkin' Money. And so I get there with, I don't even know why I bothered to go with 5 minutes left in the meeting, but I did. Maybe I need to talk to somebody or something. So I walk in the room. The room is full. There's one empty seat. It was actually a piano bench. I walk in, I sit at the piano bench, and the leader goes, well, we got time for one last person to share. How about that newcomer over there next to Richard? So, I mean, I knew the leader. He knew who I was, and there was some guy here who had identified as a newcomer. And the guy goes, all right. He goes, my name's Drew, and I'm an alcoholic. And he says, 3 weeks ago, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sure nobody would answer the phone because it was after business hours. And he said, some guy answered the phone. And for me to be able to respond to him, I had to pull a barrel of a gun out of my mouth. And I had it cocked and loaded, ready to end it. And he says, and then I got to talking to this guy, and I wound up going to a meeting. I've been coming to meetings ever since, and I think this thing might just work. I know this man, you know. So the meeting ends then, right? So we talk a little bit after the meeting, and I said, you know, we recounted that night a little bit, and I said, why didn't you tell me about the gun? And he says, well, does the term 5150 mean anything to you? Well, if somebody here doesn't know what that means, ask somebody who just laughed. they'll explain it to you, Lucy. Anyway, so this guy stays sober. And he gets sober. He stays sober a couple of years, does what we do, gets married, has a couple of kids, moves out to, I don't know, Corona or Ontario or way over there somewhere. But he stays sober, and he comes back into Seal Beach to our meeting every year to celebrate his birthday back then, you know. And he always brings his then wife and his kids, and his wife's mother always comes, and she sees me, and she globs onto me and gets all teary and stuff. And that went on for year after year after year. And then Drew's sponsor got drunk and died from alcoholism quickly, within 6 months, you know. And Drew hung on and hung on and was still doing okay. And then about 15 years ago, I decided to, you know, open my little store over in Long Beach. So my friends are coming in to help me because I don't know how to do anything. We're patching walls and painting and whatever, trying to fix a place up. And while we're in there working one day, getting it ready, Drew walks in the door. And he walks in, he starts looking around, and he just starts laughing, like laughing out loud, like laughing, like, look at this place, ha ha, laughing. And he can't stop laughing. And finally, I said, Drew, it's going to clean up. It's going to be okay. You can knock off the laughing. And he says, well, I'm not laughing about what it looks like. And I said, well, then what on earth could be so funny? And he says, do you know what this building used to be? I said, yeah, it used to be a dog and cat grooming place. That's why it's such a friggin' mess. He says, no, do you know what it was before that? I said, yeah, my landlord told me before that there were architects in this unit. And Drew says, well, that's what I'm laughing about. I said, what's so funny about that? And he says, well, you don't know this about me, but I used to be an architect. And this is where I used to work. And talk about being a part of somebody else's full circle, right? By the way, after Drew's sponsor got drunk and died, I became Drew's sponsor after that. And about 3 years ago, I met him at a meeting and gave him his cake for 20 years. And how does this stuff happen, you know? Well, you know how it happens. If you're sitting in this room on New Year's Eve, you know how it happens, you know? And I'm going to tell you one more quick story, total outside issue, but Willie hasn't given me the five yet, so I'm... Now he's giving me the five. Four, okay, and it's going to be a four-minute story I've never told before, except for outside. I won't even tell you why I'm telling you. I'm just going to tell you. I have a 10-year-old daughter, I do everything with my kid, and I always go to her assemblies at school, you know. I just don't miss them, and she's in fifth grade, so I've been to all of them over the years, and every year, around May of every year, in one of their assemblies, they have this thing called Locks of Love, and they get these kids that volunteer to do this, and they line them up, and the principal gets behind and goes, well, here's Susie. Like, Susie's going to have her hair cut now, and some professional hair cutters there, like Crystal, and they cut off her hair, and they hold up her ponytail, and everybody in the audience goes, yay, Susie, and then she goes to the next one, you know, here's Kathy, and they do the same thing right down the row, and I'm always there watching this thing, thinking, this is a cool thing, you know, and last year when she was doing it, my daughter's Girl Scout troop was organizing it and hosting it and putting it on. And that time, for the first time, the principal, when she got behind each one of the kids, she says, I'm going to do something a little bit different this year. And she said, here's Susie's about ready to get her haircut. And here's what Susie wrote about why she's participating in this. And she read the two or three sentences that Susie had written, why she was willing to cut her hair off to benefit kids that lost their hair because of cancer and other kinds of problems. And by the time they got, you know, Willie and I are just sobs, you know, and I've told Willie this thing. I cried when I told him this story. But I'm watching this happen with the first four or five kids. By the fifth kid, I'm bawling my brains off, standing in the back just thinking, my God, this is a traumatic thing for these little kids. And yet they're willing to do it for some really, really, really good reasons, you know. And after the thing ended, I went to my daughter, who has long blonde hair, and I said, Catherine, what do you think about doing that next year? Would you be interested in being a part of it next year and getting your hair cut for this thing? And she says, yeah, Dad, I think I will. And I said, me too. God bless you.